Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, September 26, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good morning and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This is our September 2014 update call. And it's sponsored by our Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm Director of Publications here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two experts, both of whom should be familiar to pretty much everybody on the call. The first is Jerry Lozier, who is of counsel at Winston & Strawn. And the second is Professor Todd Zawicki, who is the Foundation Professor of Law at the George Mason University School of Law. More complete bios were provided to you in notice of the call and on our website. So I'll stop there. And the way today's call is going to work, we're going to hear from Jerry Lozier first, and then he'll turn it over to Todd Zawicki. And then with any remaining time, we'll get to your questions. So, Jerry, why don't you take it from here? The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Christian. This is the third monthly call we're doing on this subject. And by way of background, Todd and I are both on the executive committee of the Financial Services Practice Group and also on that committee's CFPB task force. And that task force provides a monthly report to the executive committee. And that report is documented in writing, in a writing that is actually placed on the Federal Society website, I believe. So I would commend to anyone interested in the subject to check the Federal Society website, because it has, I think, pretty much all every development that goes on at the CFPB and more. This month's report has 25 items. It speaks as of September 9th. We've had a little bit of a delay in getting the teleforum going because of travel schedule and scheduling conflicts. But what our plan today, this morning, is I will discuss eight of the items of the 25 on our list that I think are probably those that the audience would be most interested in. Then Todd is going to speak on some related subjects, some higher level policy observations and developments that are going to be of interest to anyone interested in the CFPB. And then we will open for questions, as Christian said. These developments in the written report are all chronological, and so I'm going to start with the oldest. And by way of background on that development, and it's an enforcement development, one of the knocks on the CFPB when it was first established was that it might not be needed vis-a-vis the banking industry, because the banking industry already is very heavily regulated. What it's needed for is to police the non-regulated consumer financial industry. And on August 13th, it was in that context the CFPB took an enforcement action against a company called USA Discounters, which is a company, privately held company, that operates retail stores that sell furniture, electronics, appliances from storefronts that are located near military bases. And many of the purchases are financed but through retail installment sales contracts. The standard contract that the USA Discounters would have a borrower sign engaged the services of an independent company to represent the service member in matters relating to compliance with the Service Members Civil Relief Act, including receipt of notices to which the service member might be lawfully entitled. And for those, by way of background real quickly, the Service Member Civil Relief Act essentially provides for debt relief to service members while they're on active duty and entitles them to certain notices. A problem that creditors have is that when a service member is on active duty, it may be hard to deliver required notices to the service member. So this contract deputized appointed this third-party company to receive these notices. But for that service, the service member was charged a $5 fee. $4.50 of which would be remitted to the independent company. Well, it turns out this fee was the only source of revenue to this company, and there allegedly were no actual services ever performed by the company, and so the CFPB took the position that the USA Discounters was charging service members for services that really were non-existent, and so they imposed a $50,000 fine and a required refund of all of these fees on that company. The second development I'm going to mention is a compliance bulletin that was issued on August 19th by the CFPB. One knock on the CFPB that continues is that unlike most agencies that make policy, establish policy by Administrative Procedure Act rulemaking, the CFPB often decrees policy unilaterally by various means. It may issue a guidance. It may actually be contained in a blog post. It can be reflected in an enforcement action. And in this case, it was contained in a compliance bulletin and policy guidance issued to retail residential mortgage servicers. When mortgage servicing rights are transferred, there is concern on the part of CFPB that inadequate information may be transferred, thereby putting the consumer at risk. And certainly a consumer who is in the midst of negotiating a loss mitigation, that if that doesn't transfer properly when the servicing is transferred, that can harm the consumer. Bank regulators recently have increased the amount of capital required to be held by banks and banking affiliates against mortgage servicing rights, and so many mortgage servicers, bank-related mortgage services, are transferring their mortgage servicing rights, so there's been a very high volume of this. And the heart of the guidance requires the submission of so-called informational plans in the case of some significant servicing transfers. A third development on that same day, August 19th, and this is by way of irony and humor, perhaps. On August 19th, the Boston Globe issued a report. By way of background, let me mention the CFPB website, you may know, contains consumer complaints, and the CFPB encourages consumers to submit complaints to their website. The Boston Globe did an analysis of the complaints that had been received and an analysis of the geographic jurisdiction from which they the complaints originated, and concluded that the jurisdiction with the highest number of consumer complaints to the CFPB was, drum roll please, Washington, D.C., with 123 complaints per 100,000 residents. Delaware was second, and Maryland was third. So that is sort of interesting, I guess. The next day, on August 20th, the CFPB issued filed another consent order against a non-regulated financial company. This one is called First Investor Financial Services Group, Inc. And this company, based in Texas, takes assignments of retail installment sales contracts for cars, and also makes direct auto loans to consumers, usually consumers that have credit problems. Now, again, by way of background, the Fair Credit Reporting Act requires that firms, usually lenders, that furnish information to credit reporting agencies provide complete and accurate information to them. And that's where First Investor Financial Services Group, Inc. allegedly had problems. And the problems were pretty extensive. Apparently, in 2011, this firm learned that it was inaccurately reporting customer payment history, and they went to work to correct that problem, but it took them 9 months to correct it. But in the meantime, it kept knowingly reporting inaccurate customer payment history information. Same with the dates of initial delinquency. Those were inaccurately reported, and it took the company 32 months to correct that, but in the meantime, it continued to report inaccurate information. Same with it overstated past due amounts. It took the company 26 months to fix that, during which they continued to report overstatements of the past due amounts. They systematically underreported, allegedly, the amount that many of the customers were paying, and it took them 7 months to fix that. So bottom line, they were for a considerable period of time knowingly reporting inaccurate information about debtors to the credit reporting agencies, and the consequence was they consented to pay a $2.75 million civil money penalty. Ironic development, 2 days later, on August 22nd, the CFPB joined the bank regulators in an interagency guidance. But the background is sort of interesting. Historically, before the CFPB was created, the authority to control unfair or deceptive credit practices rested with the bank regulatory agencies, the Federal Reserve, FDIC, OCC. But when the CFPB was created, that jurisdiction transferred to the CFPB. The regulators just recently got around to repealing their old regulations on unfair or deceptive credit practices. And what I, in my judgment, is sort of ironic, the guidance that was issued on August 22nd by the CFPB and the bank regulators warned people that even though these bank regulations have been repealed, the agencies will continue to enforce them and to look out and examine for violations of those repealed regulations. So this is the world we live in. 3 days later, August 25th, and this is a lot more serious, and this is the sixth development I want to mention. Some people may follow what has been going on with a company called Corinthian Colleges, Inc., which is a for-profit university system. That company essentially is being shut down as a consequence of a decision by the Department of Education to suspend student aid because allegedly Corinthian exaggerated job placement prospects for its students and misled the students as to their ability to get jobs. And this has a CFPB component, of course, because a lot of these students have student loans to finance their education. On the 25th, the Corinthian Colleges, Inc. reported that the CFPB had barred an attempt by it to sell student loans. And this is a pretty serious thing. Corinthian is not a small operation. It has 72,000 students at 107 campuses. The CFPB on the 25th reportedly was conditioning settlement talks on Corinthian seizing the transfer of student loans and agreeing to inform the CFPB of any potential sale of assets, and also on its Corinthians providing students more information about the possible sale or shutdown of its campuses. More recently, even though our report speaks of September as of September 9th, on September 16th, the CFPB sued Corinthian seeking rescission of 130,000 student loans worth roughly $568 million. Corinthian disputes the facts in the CFPB complaint and points out that thousands of its students have been hired. Only 40% get loans. So that's a fairly serious development. The seventh development I would mention, and this also is sort of borders on humor or irony, and that is 2 days later, on August 27th, the CFPB issued a report on promoting financial wellness in the workplace. This is our government at work. According to the CFPB, financial worries are cited by 7 out of 10 workers as their most common source of stress. So the report contains case studies that are designed to educate employers on how to improve employee financial health. Finally, the last thing I want to report on September 3rd, the CFPB issued a warning to credit card issuers that luring consumers in and then hitting them with surprise charges are against the law. What the CFPB appears to be concerned with are so-called balance transfer promotions in which consumers are told they will not have to pay any interest or pay only low interest on balances that are transferred from other credit cards. But the fine print provides that if they may be required to pay full interest on new purchases unless they pay off the entire statement balance by the monthly billing due date. So that's sort of a technical thing, but it was seemed to be of interest. Todd?
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks for that update. I'm going to take about 10 or 15 minutes also and talk about some of the things that caught my eye. Several of them have actually come out just in the past couple of weeks, as Jerry noted, since the last list. The first thing I want to mention, a lot of us have for quite some time been following the sort of astounding story of Operation Choke Point, which the Congress, Republicans in Congress have been very aggressively holding oversight hearings. This is something that happened a while back, but I don't think we mentioned on the call, which is that back in July, I think it was, the FDIC actually withdrew its hit list of companies that were on the Operation Choke Point list. Several of you may have known that already. It's not clear what the long-run effect of that will be, but nobody thinks it's going to actually change the long-run course of Operation Choke Point. If anybody on the call knows anything more or has any stories from the field about interactions with Operation Choke Point, obviously I hope you'll share those in the comments. The biggest area over the past few weeks has been in the area of auto lending. On September 18th, the CFPB had a field hearing in Indianapolis, and in connection with that, issued three major documents. The first one was it announced a plan to propose new federal oversight of non-bank auto finance companies. So these would be direct auto lenders who compete with banks, and traditionally not the CFPB has not had a supervisory program in place for them. They have defined a larger auto non-bank auto finance companies as those that initiate more than 10,000 loans per year. They will be 10,000 aggregate annual originations, which is calculated by adding the following transactions: credit granted for the purposes of purchasing an automobile, refinancing and subsequent refinancings, purchases or acquisitions of such credit obligations, and finally, and importantly, automobile leases and purchases or acquisitions of automobile leases. So it's not just auto loans, it's also automobile leases that will be covered by the CFPB's new supervisory program. The second thing that the CFPB issued at that same time was what they called a supervisory highlight. And the supervisory highlight was designed to address perceived discrimination in the auto lending market. And this builds on the original indirect auto lending bulletin. It is designed to supposedly provide some guidance to market participants as to what's going to run afoul of the CFPB's rules for discrimination in terms of discriminatory lending patterns in terms of implementing the original bulletin that went after this. And as you know, this is a story that I've been following for a while. The most significant part of this is, and why I say it supposedly gives some guidance, is they also issued at the same time a report entitled Using Publicly Available Information to Proxy for Unidentified Race and Ethnicity. And as those who have followed this will be aware, this makes basically banks and non-bank auto lenders responsible not only for their own any patterns of discrimination as measured by disparate impact, not by any actual showing of discrimination, but it also makes those lenders responsible for indirect loans, essentially loans made by dealers that are essentially financed by money provided by the banks and the non-bank lenders. Now, the obvious problem with that is that the auto dealers actually do not provide race and ethnicity data when they are essentially seeking bids to make loans at the dealership. In a somewhat bold statement, in my view, the CFPB has stuck to the story that it doesn't matter that the non-bank lenders and the banks are providing the money have no actual information about the race or ethnicity of the person seeking the loan. They are still responsible for any perceived disparate impact in the terms of the loans offered. And they're basically saying, they talk about proxy data. So for instance, a name like Washington, which could be one race in one area of the country and a different race in another area of the country, they will be required to essentially determine whether or not it's likely or not that any given Washington is of a particular race or ethnicity. And essentially, of course, as we've talked about previously, the CFPB has no authority by law under Dodd-Frank to directly regulate auto dealers. They've essentially deputized banks and non-bank lenders into arms of the government to essentially execute their plans by sort of privately deputizing them and make them responsible for their customers. As you can see in the most recent thing, as I said, not only the loans that are made, but the loans that they acquire, it appears that there's no logical stopping point. It could be the customers of the customers, if that is if they deem that is necessary to execute their regulatory mandate. One other issue on auto lending is, some may have seen the article in the New York Times this week and a previous one. The New York Times has stirred up somewhat of a, even for the New York Times, somewhat astonishingly ill-informed kerfuffle about a perceived boom in subprime auto loans. I've written about this extensively on my blog at Washington Post. Essentially, there has been a growth in subprime auto loans. That is true, but it remains well below the period where it was before the financial crisis. And essentially what happened is that market simply collapsed during the financial crisis. One will read in vain for any recognition by the New York Times other than a chart that they themselves provide that the subprime auto bubble seems to be completely unsubstantiated. Delinquencies and defaults on auto loans are near an all-time low or at an all-time low. Whatever is going on in that market, it seems to be recovering. But nevertheless, of course, the New York Times says regulators should act swiftly and aggressively to address a problem that they've provided no evidence that actually exists. A couple other points. A few weeks ago, the CFPB issued a data point study on overdraft protection in some conversations with people at the CFPB and other intelligence. I just thought it would be useful for those on the call. Several of us had wondered what these data point studies are that come out of the CFPB periodically. It appears that they are studies by the Bureau of Economics. They are named studies in the sense that particular economists do them. They put their names on them, unlike these white papers that come out from the CFPB periodically, which are generally of very low quality and have sort of sweeping regulatory conclusions. The data points are designed to be purely, essentially academic, to provide new information about the field and provide new data that the CFPB has acquired, and are noticeable in that the language of the reports themselves are scrubbed of any regulatory conclusions, unlike the white papers that periodically the CFPB issues, where they gin up a lot of fiery language at the beginning and the end, and then provide analysis in the middle that doesn't support their conclusions generally. on the most recent CFPB data point, those who are interested, Michael Flores and I have written a brief commentary that you can find on SSRN.com, making a couple points about the data point study. The main point, basically stressing what I've implied, the economists themselves have over there have implied, is that based on that data point alone, they have not made the case for further regulation of overdraft protection. Most notably, the CFPB's data that they've acquired from their supervisory efforts are drawn only from large banks, of course. That's who they supervise. And so it turns out that the overdraft patterns of large banks are different from small banks. Most people don't realize this, but large banks only draw about 12% of their revenues from overdraft protection. The smallest banks draw 27% of their revenues from overdraft protection. So as the CFPB is considering new restrictions on overdraft protection, which seems clear, one thing that they should keep in mind is that anything that they do will have a dramatically disproportionate effect on small banks. This is particularly important in that, in the wake of the Durbin Amendment, as I've previously written, access to free checking has declined dramatically at large banks as they've imposed new fees to make up for the price controls imposed by the Durbin Amendment. So far, small banks have been able to maintain free checking for consumers. But if there's any regulations that impose a large revenue loss on small banks, we can see to expect the same sort of problems to develop for small banks and to hit consumers. So there is a dramatically unrepresentative sample of banks that comprise the CFPB data points. So while it's useful, its regulatory purpose may be somewhat limited. Two last things very quickly. The first is, and I've written about this on my blog as well in the Washington Post, a few weeks ago, the head of Wells Fargo announced in a statement that mirrored statements have been made by Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan that in light of regulatory uncertainty and litigation risk, Wells Fargo is exiting the market for making loans to low-income consumers, especially the risk of putbacks that the government has been imposing on the banks has just made it too costly and too risky to make low-income loans, and Jamie Dimon has said the same thing, and they are exiting the market. The irony of this is, as the Wall Street Journal noted in an article that ironically appeared about the exact same time, the percentage of mortgage loans being made by non-bank lenders has risen dramatically in the first quarter up to about 25%. Now, the irony here is clear, which is that to the extent that regulators are concerned that largely unregulated non-bank lenders were a problem that they thought contributed to the financial crisis, essentially what they're doing now is driving out through regulation and litigation risk, the regulated entities, and essentially bringing in unregulated entities. Now, that obviously is not inherently a problem. Competition is good. It's good that you've got new entrants who are filling this important need, this important niche. But obviously, it raises certainly some concerns about unintended consequences flowing from this if that trend continues of large banks exiting the market and non-bank lenders filling it. The final thing I will note occurred this morning. The Department of Defense announced something something that has been in the works for a while and been well known, which is that the Department of Defense, in connection with the CFPB, will be issuing new regulations expanding the products that are covered by the Military Lending Act, which was enacted originally in 2006 and covered products such as payday lending, tax refund anticipation loans, I believe, certain auto title loans and the like. They are going to now impose a 36% APR ceiling on all products for military lenders, which will of course dry up a lot of credit. The largest one that'll probably be impacted will be, from what I could tell, is personal finance installment loans, which have grown since those other products such as payday lending have been were introduced, and that will be a product that will be difficult to fit within the 36 APR cap unless they dramatically increase the size of the loan, and I can elaborate on that later. Of course, the greatest beneficiaries of this most likely are to be overdraft protection. I've previously referred to the first military lending act as the Overdraft Protection Stimulus Act. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal a little while back that said basically of the top 10 largest banks, the top 10 banks in terms of the largest amount of their revenues driven by overdraft protection, a disproportionate number of them are military lending banks. And the reason is obvious, as I've previously documented, which is payday lending and overdraft protection are treated as substitutes for consumers. Whenever you take away payday lending, overdraft protection usage increases dramatically, as well as bounce checks and the like. If, in fact, this rule only applies and applies the 36% APR to products other than bank overdraft protection, this will likely be a huge boon for banks issuing bank overdraft protection in and around military bases until, of course, the CFPB cracks down on that as well. And then it could be that the military lenders are left with Tony Soprano and his buddies stepping in to fill the gap. I don't know yet. The rule will not be issued till Monday. Perhaps it says something about overdraft protection. I've not been able to figure that out yet. But that would be the most likely consequence of this, would be to be a dramatic increase in the use of overdraft protection by military members. So with that, we can turn it over to questions and discussion.
All right. Well, in a moment, we'll open the floor to your questions. You'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and the pound key. All right. Well, looks like we had one question jump on the line.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems we have a broader problem here, a pattern of nudging private entities into serving as effectively instrumentalities of a government to exercise powers that it doesn't have the powers to exercise directly. And the dangers of that should be clear, as you brought out in this discussion, but the question is, what can we do about it? Because under 14th Amendment precedents, if a private party acts at the instigation of a state actor to deprive someone of his rights, he may be considered himself a state actor. And this suggests a line of litigation whereby private parties who act as agents of the federal government become federal actors and are themselves subject to liability for having done so, without the protections that would accord them if they were truly part of the government enjoying sovereign immunity. So this would seem to open a door to creating, to pursuing liability for things that may want to discourage them from participating as subcontractors of the government.
Thanks, John. I largely agree with what you say, and what we're seeing again and again and again and again is the danger and the poison that is introduced into not only the economy but for individual liberty in a society where we have such a deep entanglement between government and financial institutions, and especially banks, which is today there is so much entanglement, so much broad discretion of the government that essentially, and this symbiotic relationship in particular, where the government can either destroy an institution, as Jerry well says with respect to Corinthian, they've essentially destroyed Corinthian by shutting off access to financing, as they've tried to do with Operation Choke Point, and they can essentially drive you to your knees, or as we see with the entrenchment of too big to fail, they can reward you for playing ball with them. And we are reaping this now again and again, whether it's, as we said, Operation Choke Point, whether it's turning banks and non-bank lenders into arms of the government for purposes of policing auto dealers beyond what is permitted by Dodd-Frank, or a lot of these other things that we're seeing, which is that the financial sector today exists at the, and really as for a long time, but was really entrenched by the financial crisis, exists at the whim and mercy of the bank regulators, who have very little transparency about what they're doing, and essentially through this vague and capacious term of reputation risk, can essentially just give you a nudge and a wink, and essentially force you to do what they don't even have to tell you what to do. They can just hint at what you need to do. And I think until we come to grips with the full scope of the impact on the economy and individual liberty of this sort of government entrenchment with our financial sector and our banks, I think we are on a very, very slippery slope here. And what that also does is, as you suggested, is it makes it private parties reluctant to stand up and sue to protect their rights. I give a lot of credit to the payday lending industry, who actually brought the lawsuit challenging the Operation Choke Point, but that took a lot. And if you read that complaint, it's astonishing the abuse that industry has taken. It's a legal industry, and if they don't like it, then they need to do something about that. But the back channels and all the things that have happened to that, but that's rare. And until people challenge these things, until banks and non-bank lenders and auto dealers actually challenge these things in court, it's gonna continue. Is my concern. And the reason they don't challenge it is because the regulators have made it pretty clear that they don't like to be challenged. So we've got a pretty terrible situation, in my view.
Todd, can I just add that from the perspective of traditional bank regulation, where this issue really has historically come up is in the area of Bank Secrecy Act, anti-money laundering, know your customer, file suspicious activity reports. A lot of people do not understand that if you as a customer engage in a transaction at the bank, you make a deposit that's larger than ordinary or a withdrawal that's larger than ordinary, the bank, it raises a red flag at the bank, and the bank is under an obligation to look into what you're doing, and if there's no satisfactory answer, to file a so-called suspicious activity report with the U.S. Treasury Department that's used by law enforcement. And when people worry about the NSA spying on them, it just is amazing to me that people do not rise up in rebellion, knowing that their banks are legally obligated and they're severely fined if they don't file those reports with the government about the unusual activities that their customers engage in. To me, that is a real civil liberties issue.
Well, we don't have any more questions right now, so let's go. Let's do another call. If you'd like to ask a question, the lines are open, so please press star and then the pound key. We do have over 50 people on the call, so we. Right. Oh, we did have one jump on.
Yes, this is Mark Freeman from KeyBank. Where do some of these policy initiatives come from or start? Do they come from the regulatory agencies themselves? Are there working groups within the White House? Sort of where do these focuses develop that result in sort of these programs?
It depends, Mark. Some of them were, of course, initially imposed by Dodd-Frank, right? So Dodd-Frank, for instance, required the promulgation of the qualified mortgages rule, which is part of this overall structure that's driving a lot of banks out of the mortgage lending market because of all those regulatory costs. But most of them are just ginned up and generated internally, just by something that they decide to do. Of course, one of the real concerns here is how many times now the CFPB in particular is simply evading traditional rulemaking processes and the like. So, for instance, the again, recall this this mandate on discriminatory lending was issued by a regulatory bulletin. That basically said, we have no evidence of actual systematic discrimination here, but we think that there's potential for discrimination here. Where did that come from? Obviously, that's something that activists have desired for a long time. But it's just striking that it wasn't done by regulation. It wasn't even done by formal enforcement where somebody could challenge it. It was done by a bulletin that was basically a veiled threat to non-bank lenders. So most of this is simply generated internally. And as we've talked about previously, the CFPB, because of its unique structure, is unusually insulated from review by Congress in this case, and even if a Republican, for instance, were to take the White House, the CFPB is largely insulated from the president himself. They are also insulated from the Federal Reserve, and so most of these things are simply generated internally as something that they decide that they want to do, and that they want to do in a particular way. Jerry, do you have anything to add?
No. I mean, in essence, that's really true. I mean, there have been, you know, stories and reports that the CFPB is staffed by activists and aggressive enforcement attorneys and et cetera, et cetera.
All right. Well, our lines are open, so if you'd like to jump in, we still have time for questions. So press star and then the pound key if you'd like to get on and ask a question of either or both of our experts. All right. Looks like we had one more jump on.
Thanks, guys. This is Jack Park. Isn't another problem, you know, when any enforcement action comes down, the simplest thing to do is cave and pay a fine or, you know, exit the market. So their enforcement is rarely, if ever, tested.
Yeah,
That's exactly right, Jack. I mean, that's what I was sort of suggesting is that that it's in the individual interest of each person to try to make it go away, right? To not fight back, engage in a high profile battle that's going to be expensive, and the like, especially as we've said, where they're so weakened by the fact that that the regulators have so many other tools to get at them. In addition to just straight enforcement. So occasionally you'll get, it seems the only time you ever get fighting back, whereas it's essentially bet the company litigation, which is what happened, for instance, when Morgan Drexen finally challenged the CFPB. That was essentially a bet the company litigation when the CFPB was shutting them down. And payday lending seems to have been approaching that level in the way in which Operation Choke Point was bleeding the payday industry, payday lending industry to business to death, or choking off the air as they intended. So that's right. The individual incentives are always to settle and have things go away, Jack.
Okay, thanks.
Well, this is Christian. One quick programming note that actually is very relevant to our discussion here and our speakers is the Federal Society on Tuesday, September 30th, is co-sponsoring with the Cato Institute an event on consumer credit in the American economy, featuring our Todd Zawicki, who's going to be discussing the topic, and that's here in D.C. at the Cato Institute. More information about that is available on our website, as well as the Cato Institute's website.
Sounds like it's going to be a great program.
If you don't say so yourself.
That's right.
Well, let's see. Our lines are open, so let's do a last call here for questions. So star and then the pound key. All right. Well, it looks like we've exhausted the questions. Jerry or Todd, do you have any concluding thoughts before we wrap up here?
I have none. Todd?
Nope.
Oh,
no,
hey,
I think
we had someone jump on with a last minute question, and since we've got time, we'll go ahead and go to them.
Hey. Sorry, Larry Callahan. I tried to enter the floor by using my computer instead of my phone. Are any of the congressional committees, who I know involved in very important things, looking into what a friend of Jerry's and mine once referred to as much foolishness? It just seems these things just kind of roll along. And even with Republicans, it does not. Is there some effort to try to redirect the efforts of these folks?
I think so, Larry. I mean, to their credit, Patrick McHenry's been very aggressive in House oversight in going after this. Daryl Issa, they've done a good job on Operation Choke Point, for instance. One fears, however, that any accomplishments they actually get are largely cosmetic. So, for instance, I think they, as we talked about, they managed to persuade the FDIC to withdraw its hit list, but no one seriously thinks that means that the that banks haven't gotten the message. I also know, I've heard reports of banks, of industries that weren't even on the FDIC's hit list, but which seem to have a profile similar to those that are on the hit list, that were on the hit list. So oversight, they can push a little bit. The fundamental problem here, of course, is twofold, which is first, this administration is really, to put it bluntly, lawless, executive lawlessness beyond anything we've ever seen, combined with a docile media environment that allows executive, astonishing executive overreach that just keeps coming and coming, combined with the fact that the CFPB is exactly that on steroids, which is Congress lacks any effective tools to actually get the CFPB to toe the line without any budgetary authority, without any ability to control personnel, any of those sorts of things. Congress is completely bereft of the typical tools it would have to be able to exert any leverage to actually get cooperation out of this body. And as we were just discussing, judicial review, which often might be a way of trying to rein in discretion, is largely limited here by the fact that nobody's willing to actually challenge the CFPB on a lot of these things. So it's sort of the modern all the problems that we've talked about in the modern administrative state with executive overreach squared in this area.
In some, I gather, it's just simply run amok. Thanks.
I think that's right. So for instance, basically what seems to be the case is the FDIC withdrew its hit list, but you've got those bank examiners out there in the banks who've gotten the message. And what those bank examiners are doing on a day-to-day basis is hard to keep track of. The conversations that are never put on paper, or the hints that are out there being delivered by bank examiners out in the field are something that they've obviously gotten the message, at least from all reports. But it's really hard to exert oversight over something as diffuse as that, unless you get a strong forceful instructions to the contrary that basically tells them that your previous orders are inoperative, I think.
Todd, let me mention one very quick last-minute development. This morning it was reported, I'm embarrassed to say, on NPR, that a New York Federal Reserve Bank examiner, Carmen Segarra, apparently taped 46 hours of conversations, not just telephone conversations, inside the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and at Goldman Sachs, reflecting the interaction between Goldman Sachs and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And she has released, or her lawyer has released, those tapes, and they were playing them on NPR this morning. And it's very, very interesting as far as listening to how a bank examiner talks to a bank, to a banker, and the interchange between them.
That sounds like it sounds like maybe NPR was worth listening to for a change.
Yeah, very, very interesting.
Well, it looks like we are out of questions. So I want to thank, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank both Jerry Lozier and Todd Zawicki for joining us once again and providing this installment of our CFPB update series. We look forward to bringing you more of these. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. If you're in town in D.C., don't forget to check out Consumer Credit in the American Economy on Tuesday, September 30th, as well as our D.C. Lawyers Chapter Luncheon next Thursday, October 2nd, with Lynn Cheney on her new James Madison biography. So until the next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.